This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Nicole Foss. She's the senior editor of the blog The Automatic Earth, where she writes on issues ranging from peak oil to finance. She writes a lot about bubbles and their aftermath, what we're living through right now. She discusses the sovereign debt crisis in Europe, and in fact, the blog The Automatic Earth is one of the top 10 finance blogs on the internet. Nicole Foss, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we're here at the beginning of the year, and people are predicting in the business pages, at least in the United States, the economic recovery will continue. But you've said the economic recovery is an illusion. Why do you say that?
It was a counter-trend rally. The larger trend has been down since October 2007, but no market ever moves in only one direction. So we had a long sucker rally, if you like. There was a similar sucker rally in 1930 during the crash phase of the market back then. Basically, it keeps people invested. It reignites hope and confidence temporarily. But the trend changed again to the downside in May this year. So we are now several months into the next phase of the credit crunch. So we're starting to see more alarming news. But all these market moves, because they're swings of positive feedback, don't start off with a bang necessarily. They pick up momentum as they go along. So we've been picking up momentum to the downside. I'm fully expecting that to start turning into some market cascade. And where the markets lead, the real economy will follow, because the same shift from optimism to pessimism drives both finance and the real economy, but it drives finance faster, which makes finance a leading indicator that tells you where the real economy is going. Because we saw the markets turn the corner months ago, the real economy was unnoticed from that point. Now I think we're going to start to see significant contraction in the real economy as well.
Though in early January, I mean, Wall Street started off with a bang, and all the people who have investments, either psychological or real, in the stock market the flax for the stock market seem to be suggesting otherwise. You're thinking that it's just kind of like a dead cat bounce, as we say.
Oh, absolutely. There's tremendous volatility in bear markets because people have the sense that down is unnatural. Somehow up is natural, so up tends to be smooth. Down, because people have this sense of unsettlement, it's unnatural that things should go down. There's tremendous volatility. If you look at some of the biggest upward moves happened during the crash in the 1930s. So we not only have very major moves to the downside, we also have very large moves to the upside on short squeezes and things like that. So this is just simply near-term volatility.
And why do you think the long term is so gloomy?
We have created, in our 30 years of credit expansion, a pile of debt that cannot conceivably be serviced by the real economy any longer. The marginal productivity of debt went negative in 2008. So did credit shifted into reverse for the first time since World War II. So this is a major event. This is why we had the financial crisis of 2008, which was actually phase one of the credit crunch. The rally was a temporary interlude. We're now moving into phase two of the credit crunch. The consequences of unpayable debt are once again coming home to roost. And we're not yet seeing that so much in the United States. The focus at the moment is Europe. Because of the sovereign debt crisis, the debt situation is simply far worse in Europe. The leverage situation is far worse.
And that's what you call phase two of the crisis, the Europe debt crisis?
Well, it begins in Europe, but financial contagion is simply the spread of fear. And what we're seeing is fear that started in Greece and spread to Portugal and Ireland and is now working its way into the European core with the market attack on French banks, for instance, problems that Belgium is having. It's working its way towards the core. People are now quite openly discussing the demise of the single currency, possibly this year.
Do you think that's going to happen?
Oh, yes.
The euro is going to collapse.
Oh, I firmly believe that it is. And it could easily be this year. We could start to see the eurozone shrink in the first quarter of this year because we are very close to crisis level. There is so much debt that has to be rolled over. But what happens, the problem you end up with when people are suddenly afraid that you can't repay your debt, you can no longer roll over short-term debt at a rate of interest you can conceivably afford. So you hit a brick wall at 100 miles an hour. And what we have is a collateral crisis. So we have a tiny amount of underlying collateral and a vast amount of debt. So I would call that our credit expansion has created excess claims to underlying real wealth through overpledging of collateral, a lot of which went through London, which is one of the reasons this crisis is partly centered in Europe, although London is not itself in the Eurozone. But we're going to see the spread of fear from Europe to various other places. China is in contraction. India is in contraction. We're not just seeing this as a phenomenon of one part of the world. This is global. The global banking system is enormously interconnected. And when interbank lending starts to seize up, as it did in 2008 and is beginning to do now, the knock-on effects will be global.
China and India are slowing down. They're not actually going in reverse. They're just not booming at 10 or 11 or 18% as China was for a while there, right? I mean, it's not like they're in recession.
China, oh, they will be.
You think they will?
They're very much moving in that direction because the credit markets lead, the real economy follows. So the fact that we're starting to see contraction financially is going to lead to contraction in the real economy. But what China's facing is probably something like what Japan was looking at. So you have the elimination of credit. You don't have what looks like an outright deflation necessarily, as the 1930s did in America, because you have a big pile of money to burn through. But you have credit contraction, and you have a fall in the velocity of money. This is a critical part as well. This is very much what happened in Japan. So people stop spending because they're worried about where their next paycheck is coming from. There's so much uncertainty that money stops circulating, and that aggravates the effects of credit contraction, which is deflation by definition.
Now, let's go back to Europe for a second. Some people are suggesting, including some economists who are in Greece, progressive economists, that they should just bolt the euro, that the euro is crushing them, that Germany's insistence on these cost-cutting budgetary measures, these austerity measures, are just having ruinous impacts on people's standard of living. They'd be better just to leave it. What do you think of that?
I agree. On the whole, they would. Mind you, it would be enormously painful in the process. So the reason that they don't simply leave the euro, apart from being strong-armed not to destroy the project, is that any politician who takes actions like that that have immediate negative consequences for the population, as opposed to slightly longer-term consequences, they will be blamed for those consequences right then and there. So it's political suicide. It's a very dangerous thing for a politician to do, to ever trigger an acceleration of contraction. But absolutely, austerity is killing people. It's what you have is a situation where austerity forces economic contraction, and when your rate of economic growth is less than the rate of the interest you pay on your debt, you're in an exploding debt scenario. So you simply guarantee default. But you may kick the can down the road a little bit. What they're trying to do is keep the project together. Personally, I don't think it will work. All that I think we have in terms of options are whether the Eurozone sheds one member at a time or whether the whole thing implodes in one giant mess all at once.
What's your prediction there? Which way is it going to go?
It isn't entirely clear, but my worry is increasingly that the whole thing could go down in flames all at once, particularly because the contagion is spreading to the core. And there has been a perception that everybody other than the periphery is fine. But increasingly, people have been saying, well, Belgium hasn't had a government for a long time, and Dexia that went under recently was 180% of GDP. Belgium can't pay its share of bailing out Dexia. The French banks are under attack. They're too big to fail. They're a multiple of French GDP each. The Netherlands has a massive housing bubble. Germany's banks funded everybody else's housing bubble. There's huge exposure to the periphery. So there's increasingly a sense that, oh dear, we appear to be all tied together. So we may sink together or swim together. But so they're trying to create a sense of the obligation to create fiscal union, euro bonds. It's never going to work. There'll never be a political mandate for it. Basically, Germany and Finland and the Netherlands, for instance, would have to essentially vote to pay everybody else's debts. You just don't have the power to deliver that kind of promise. So they're promising it without having the ability to deliver. And when everybody realizes that this is yet another promise that cannot be kept, it's not going to work.
I'm speaking with Nicole Foss. She's the senior editor of the blog The Automatic Earth, which is one of the most read financial blogs on the internet. She has these dire predictions of where we're headed financially, and I think it's worth us taking a look as to what that would mean here in the United States. The Federal Reserve Board in late 2011 tried to throw a a little life jacket to Europe too, and there was some speculation that the Fed would do whatever it would take to keep the euro going, though Ben Bernanke has since denied that. Do you think the Fed will try to come in again? And well, let's start there. What do you think?
No, I don't think so. And I also don't think it would make any difference even if they did. There isn't enough wealth in the world to bail out Europe. The debt in Europe that is unpayable is a multiple of global GDP. So we're in a situation where we have simply reached a limit. Our credit expansion can no longer expand because it's a Ponzi scheme. Ponzi schemes that can no longer expand will implode.
What is the effect going to be on the United States, not to get too parochial, if the euro collapses?
Well, essentially, the global banking system is highly interconnected. So interbank lending seizing up would affect the United States, the banks here as well. We almost seized up the global banking system in September 2008. We came within hours of doing that. This time, I don't think we'll be so lucky in avoiding that instance. So I think we could easily be looking at bank holidays, and that could easily be this year. But there will be some short-term beneficial effects for the United States as well, because money moves from where fear is to where fear is not. And all you have to be where fear is not, is to be the least worst option. So despite the horrendous financial situation with debt in the States, it is perceived that it will never default. It is the least worst option. This is why the interest rates on your bonds are next to nothing. You hardly have to pay anything to insure against a sovereign debt default by the United States in the CDS market relative to almost everywhere in Europe. So we're going to see huge capital flight from Europe into anything that isn't in the Eurozone. So already we're seeing this into Swiss francs. We may yet see it into British pounds, Swedish krona, most definitely into the US dollar, because the US dollar is the reserve currency. It bottomed some months ago. It's already in the early stages of a very large increase in value relative to other currencies, I would predict. So we're going to see a knee-jerk flight to safety into the US dollar as the reserve currency, as the least worst option. And also, as dollar-denominated debt deflates, when there's more of it than any other kind in the world, that will create demand for dollars to pay down dollar-denominated debt. So there are forces that are going to significantly raise the value of the dollar internationally. We will still deal with fallout in terms of the banking system potentially seizing up. We can't count on FDIC guarantees under those circumstances. They were never meant to deal with a systemic banking crisis. So it's not that the U.S. will be bought years worth of time before they have to worry about anything, but at least in terms of maintaining the value of the currency and not having to pay ruinous interest rates on the bonds, in that sense, the European crisis is likely to buy the United States some time.
And you see this all adding up to the gradual decline or sudden decline of Europe and the U.S. and the rise of China?
I think Europe is facing the largest decline of all. There was a UBS report not so long ago that basically extrapolated the likely impact of the collapse of the Eurozone on various European countries. That varied between 20% of GDP in the first year for countries of the core like Germany, 50% of GDP in the first year for peripheral countries. That's worse than World War II. So the impact would be massive in Europe. All the breaking up of trading relationships and the seizing up of trade and the cessation of movement of money across borders. In the United States, I think we would be looking at a very substantial economic contraction. I think we're moving into another Great Depression. So that comes with an economic seizure. Because the velocity of money crashes as well as the supply of credit, you end up with very little money circulating in the economy, and money is the lubricant in the engine of the economy in the way that motor oil is the lubricant in the engine of your car. You try to run any kind of engine without enough lubricant, it will seize up on you, exactly as it did in the Great Depression. Under those circumstances, you can't connect buyers and sellers, producers and consumers, so things freeze up for a period of time in the early phase of a depression. The acute phase of liquidity crunch doesn't last forever, but it can be a very uncomfortable period of time, as it was in the 30s. I do think we're seeing the rise of China over the longer term. It is the empire in the ascendancy. I think we're in the very early stages of a shift of hegemonic power. But China has a massive setback in very much the way that the 1930s were the setback of the dawn of the American century, because things had overreached themselves in the roaring 20s. Now, things have drastically overreached themselves in China with the state-sponsored development model that has led to massive malinvestment and huge amounts of bad debt in their system. This is what is now contracting and deflating there. They are facing a significant setback, tremendous environmental problems. They have huge overpopulation. They're facing enormous water issues. They're going going to be dealing with energy issues. So they have a major setback. The fact that they also have a huge gender imbalance is an almost 100% predictor of conflict somewhere. Not necessarily there, but people who are excess young men with nothing to do but cause trouble tend to be sent somewhere to cause trouble elsewhere, if at all possible. So this is very likely to lead to conflict. We're also likely to see a substantial possibility of civil war in China because it is by no means a uniform society. And some places have benefited enormously from the massive Chinese bubble. Other places have been left behind. There are great tensions building up there. So although I do think we will see the Chinese century, I think we have a very messy interregnum, a transition phase to get from where we are now to what the future might look like later on. And I think when I say that we're looking at a Chinese century, I'm not suggesting that that will look like the American century. There won't be the energy for it to project power at a distance. But I do think China will be the most significant power in a much more multipolar world.
I'm speaking with Nicole Foss. She's the senior editor of the blog, The Automatic Earth. How would you see the United States reconciling itself to not being the king of the hill?
Very unhappily. This is one of the reasons that I think the interregnum, the transition period, could be extraordinarily dangerous, because nobody wants to see a shift of hegemonic power away from them. In North America, and in fact, since the Enlightenment, we are used to being the colonizers, not the colonized. China is already colonizing Africa, buying up resources and sending over enough people to establish de facto control of those resources. So it's already spreading out in the way that empires in the ascendancy always do. But the fact that there are an extraordinarily large number of weapons of mass destruction in the world, not just here, but in many, many places, I think really raises the risk level. What we're, I think, looking at in the initial phase is a three-way Cold War between the U.S., China, and Russia. And that doesn't mean conflict between the great powers. Great powers typically know better than that. But what they do is they start nasty proxy wars in the periphery. They get client states in resource-rich regions because they're competing for things like oil, which is liquid hegemonic power. They develop client-state relationships, they pump them full of guns, predictable conflagrations happen in those areas. So initially, a lot of the conflict, maybe low-intensity conflict in the periphery. But I think over time, we have a very dangerous situation. I think all we can do is hope that we don't lose our minds and therefore our future during that period. But hope is really all we can do. There are some pretty crazy people who might end up with their fingers on unfortunate buttons. Mm.
Nicole Foss, staying in China for a second, I've wondered for a while, as China's middle class has grown so enormously over the last two decades or three, when we will arrive at a time where China doesn't really need the U.S. market to sell goods and can make goods and sell goods within its huge, gigantic population, as you suggested. To what extent is that possible, or is it going to need to rely on the great U.S. consumer for the foreseeable future?
Well, yes, it is going to have to rely on the U.S. consumer, but the U.S. consumer is not going to be there because they're not going to have any purchasing power. So the U.S. is the consumer of last resort. But what happens in a depression is trade relationships break down. You get protectionism and trade wars. You get neo-mercantilism. So there won't be a consumer of last resort. For China, this is a disaster because, yes, there has been the development of a Chinese middle class. It is minute compared to what it would have to be to soak up Chinese productive capacity. So the enormous overinvestment in productive capacity that's happened in China in recent years really will be an albatross around their neck. There will be no market for these goods. And short of repurposing them into munitions factories, which would be a horribly unconstructive thing to do anyway, this is just going to prove to be the conversion of capital into waste, because there's no way there's going to be any use for this productive capacity before it simply disintegrates. So I really don't think there's any way you can decouple China at the moment. Over time, over a very long period of time, as China is the empire in the ascendancy, you could actually create enough of a middle class there that you may be able to rebalance things so that it is more internally self-sufficient. But we're absolutely nowhere near that point right now.
Interesting. Going back to Europe then, and also the United States, with your prediction, Nicole Foss, of another Great Depression coming, how should people prepare for that?
Essentially, individually, hold no debt. Reduce exposure to credit if you possibly can. It's going away. You won't be able to borrow money against houses. Credit limits will be cut. all sorts of lines of credit will be cut, so we have to learn to live within our means once more. Gain some control over the essentials of your own existence if you possibly can, so food, water, energy. Eliminate, if possible, the number of middlemen between you and what you own, so banks, brokerages, you're dependent on their solvency. And as we saw with the failure of MF Global, that's a pretty dangerous overexposure to companies that are essentially teetering on the brink of insolvency already.
You know,
there
will
be
you
insurance.
I'm sorry to interrupt. It's funny you mention MF Global because in 2008, when the stock market was crashing here in the United States, I asked my brother, who studied economics more than I did, you know, what's to prevent these brokerage firms from just going in and robbing your money? He said, well, they'd never do that because then they'd go to jail. But but I guess it's so tempting, though. I mean, it must have been so tempting for them, must have been tempting for Bear Stearns, must have been tempting for Merrill Lynch and all those people just to have people's money sitting there that could cover their exposures.
Well, exactly. And what we've had is the rehypothecation of assets. So going through the London market, where you're allowed to basically overpledge your collateral an infinite number of times, they were able to create massive excess claims to underlying real wealth. And because the way the rules are set up, in a bankruptcy, the people at the top of the financial food chain are able to simply reach down and press their claim before anyone else gets a look in. Basically, possession then is 9/10 of the law. So the assets were all seized at that point to the person highest up the financial food chain who they had been pledged to as collateral. So what we're seeing, it's a massive collateral grab. So we're playing a giant game of musical chairs. There's about one chair for every 100 people playing the game. As long as the music keeps going, people don't really notice that. As soon as the music stops, all of a sudden they realize, and then you get a massive grab for chairs, for the collateral, for the underlying
real world. A lot of people fall on their asses.
Exactly. And most of the excess claims are rapidly and messily extinguished. This is why deflation plays out quickly and chaotically. It's like having the rug pulled out from under your feet. That's what happened in the 30s. That's what's going to happen now. But the problems we have now are partly that, you know, in the 30s, people lived on the land, they were skilled, they looked after themselves, their expectations were far less out of line with reality, they were far less dependent on long and vulnerable supply chains. We are much more vulnerable now, and we are facing resource limits as well of almost every kind. So we are really very, very vulnerable indeed. This is a very dangerous situation we've created. And one of the other things that I suggest that people need to do to prepare, because I've said that bank and brokerage accounts are really not safe, you're dependent on someone else's solvency, have as tight a connection between you and everything you own as you possibly can. So I tell people, hold cash, and by that I mean real physical cash under your own control, or maybe short-term treasuries under your own control, not through a separate account, because these are cash and cash equivalents. They're means of maintaining liquidity. Liquidity is unmade choices. This is what you need to get you through a liquidity crunch, because right now there isn't much in the way of opportunities. You don't even have the information as to what would be the appropriate choices to make. Down the line, preserving liquidity will allow you to make those choices at the point where the opportunities are there and the information is there as to know what opportunities to take advantage of.
But where do you hold your cash if you're not going to put it in a bank? And put it. My mother-in-law used to put it in the freezer.
Be creative.
Now, you yourself, you're telling people to live within their means, and you yourself, I read, tried to reduce the energy use in your farm in Ontario by 90% or something. How did that work out?
Well, we got rid of the electric heating. We stopped using the very old, inefficient geothermal system. We replaced our heating system with an outdoor wood-burning furnace. We put a battery bank in the basement. So we have solar panels in the backfield. We have a battery bank in the basement. We can charge the battery bank with the solar panels, with the mains, with a gasoline generator or diesel generator run by our tractor. So that gives us redundancy. If we had none of the above, we would have enough storage capacity to run the essentials for approximately 4 days, 6 deep cycle marine batteries. So we have a system that has built-in redundancy and therefore resilience. We have solar domestic hot water on the roof. We grow vegetables. We raise our own meat. We have our own egg production. We have alpacas for fiber, because that happens to be a passion of mine. So there are many things we've done to really try to build a system that is more resilient and more self-sufficient. We couldn't do it in England, where we used to live, so we moved to Canada, where property was, at the time, a far more sensible price, and bought a 40-acre farm and spent many years then learning how to use it.
You emphasize the need to go local, to build local economies, and to do such things as barter again, or use things like time banks. Can you explain how that would work?
Basically, these are means of exchanging goods and services without the need to exchange money at a time when money will be incredibly scarce. Very little of it will be circulating. So what money there actually is in the economy, people will tend to be sitting on it, as in fact they should from their perspective. But it does make life more difficult for the larger system if money is all taken out of circulation. So we have to find ways round that. Local currencies are one way round it. So you simply have a kind of scrip locally. As long as everyone agrees that it's a medium of exchange, then it is. It typically only works in a local area. Things like that, time banking is the same. It's simply changing hours for hours. So it's the same kind of local initiative that depends on trust. Trust is the key point because these things work within the trust horizon. When economic contraction happens, the trust horizon contracts as well. What tends to happen then is your higher level political institutions, international, national, maybe even state level, become stranded assets from a trust perspective. So the things that still work, work within where the trust still exists, because relationships of trust are the foundation of society at all times. Once you've lost the trust, you lose political legitimacy. So these local initiatives, these decentralized initiatives, work because trust still exists within that spatial region. So they give you alternatives. They give you the ability to transition from the system we had into whatever will come next, that they may then be able to be much more than just local.
I'm speaking with Nicole Foss of the blog, The Automatic Earth. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You talked about these national, international institutions, higher-level institutions, you call them. Is there no remedy that these, at the macro level, that these institutions could pull out of a hat?
No. Even if there was, they wouldn't do it. They're far too deeply bedded in a system that has tremendous inertia, that has been moving in one direction for a long time. No matter who is in power, by the way. So in a way, it doesn't really make much difference. The leaders tend to be figureheads and salesmen who are told to sell whatever policies the people behind the scenes have devised. So policies don't actually change a great deal from one administration to the next, quite often. The job of politicians is typically to make a bad situation worse as expensively as possible. So I do not look for solutions from the top down at all. Certainly not from the national level. Occasionally, it might be possible to do something at the state level, depending. Municipal politicians have it within their power to deliver things that make a genuine difference. And they can often do it without really even spending very much money. So I have a lot of time for municipal politicians. They can open up spaces and bring people together, simply facilitate things that need to happen at a community level. They can get rid of ridiculous rules that prevent people from being able to look after themselves by keeping chickens in their backyard and growing vegetables wherever they want. So there are many things municipal politicians can do higher up. Even if they're informed, even if they want to do something, the system in which they are embedded will not allow them to do it.
It's interesting. I've often thought mayor was a real good job to have, and sounds like you think it is too. For people who've been listening to us talk, Nicole Foss, who want to find out more about you, where should they go?
TheAutomaticEarth.blogspot.com is our website at the moment. We are in the process of moving over to a new website that will give us a lot more functionality. It's going to be TheAutomaticEarth.org. So once we move over to that, we will have a lot more expanded material available on preparation on a whole range of fronts, pretty much everything you can imagine that might allow you to develop more resilience and self-sufficiency. We also have the financial news of the day and our take on the way the world is playing out and all sorts of back resources that we've produced that are available online. All of that will be there on the new site.
And you can always just Google Nicole Foss, that's F-O-S-S. Thanks for being my guest today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.